Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David.
Hey, David.
Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. Is the mic okay? Voice level okay? How's that?
Perfect.
That's what I'm going for. I got a sobriety date. It's October 24th, 1989. I was 28 years old when I was separated from alcohol for what I hope to be the last time. Because of you guys, rooms like this, people like you, sponsorship and 12 steps, I got to be 62 years old on my last birthday. Nobody saw that coming.
Yeah.
I didn't want to live this long. So thank you for the invitation to come share. It's been really a joy to, my home group is the Simple Actions Group. We meet Monday nights over in Norfolk, 7 p.m. We're a panel-based, big book-based speaker meeting, and all month long, me and my homies been coming out here and talking, and it's been a joy to get in the car. We got that get in the car sobriety, right? And I love the name of this meeting, Into Action. And coincidentally, I'm just going to share this with you. Today's meditation, April 28th, in the 24-hour reader, it says, "We're so glad to be free from liquor that we do something about it. We get into action. We come to meetings regularly. We go out and try to help other alcoholics. We pass on the good news whenever we get a chance in a spirit of thankfulness to God. We get into action. The AA program is simple. Submit yourself to God, find release from liquor, and get into action. Do these things and keep doing them, and you're all set for the rest of your life. Have I got into action?" That was today's thought. So I'm happy to be at your home group Into Action tonight. So I said my sobriety date. I said my home group. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is aware that he sponsors me. It's not a theoretical relationship. I have the privilege of taking other men through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I believe we do here. I got a yawner already. Nice. You guys, are there any Al-Anons here tonight? I love things like this. Steve talked about it. I love when we all get together and break bread. I got an Al-Anon joke. You want to hear one?
Yes.
It's not disparaging to Al-Anons. This is a joke that maybe an Al-Anon would tell about us. You know the difference between a dog and a drunk? The dog stops whining after you let it in the house. That's the only G-rated joke I have. So. So I told you my sobriety date. I'm to give you my experience drinking. I describe myself as a reluctant member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not somebody. I first met you guys when I was 22 years old. I met you again when I was 23 years old. I met you again when I was 25 years old. We'll get into some of that stuff, but I'm not somebody who came in here and thought, "Gee, this looks like a swell idea." You know, it just looked awful to me. But anyway, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I'll tell you a story about my dad just for fun. My dad, a couple things you need to know about my dad. My dad was a heroic alcoholic. And he was my hero. He was a veterinarian. And he insisted on being called Dr. Francis. And I can remember being a little kid and being embarrassed by that. You know, he introduced himself as Dr. Francis. And I'm a little kid, and I'm thinking, come on, Pop, lighten up on the doctor thing. You know, it's like you're a dog doctor, you know what I mean? Never mind that he did all the work, and, you know, and he was proud of himself, you know? And my old man kind of had a charmed life. He was everything I'm not. He was a good athlete, you know, captain of the football team, married the head cheerleader. You know, I mean, he had it all in front of him. He thought about going pro golfing for a while, and he made a lot of money, made a lot of friends, quick with a joke. He was a lovable dude, man. He really was my hero. And this story is hearsay. It took place in 1965. I was 4 years old. My old man would have been about 35 years old at that point, and maybe 33. Doesn't matter. But anyway, he paid cash for a 1965 Malibu SS 396. Four on the floor, candy apple red, white rag top, the broad stripes on the front of the thing, you know what I mean? He drove that thing brand new, the kind of thing you'd see on a muscle car magazine, right? And he lost control of that vehicle on the way home to our house, didn't, you know, whatever, it was a 45 degree, he made about 60 of it, you know, and he went off the road, up a guy wire, into a telephone pole, the telephone pole snaps, the power goes out to the neighborhood, the car comes down on its ass end, he spills out of the car, and then he does what I consider to be a very alcoholic thing. He surveys, you know, the wreckage, and I'm going home. So he just walked home. And then the police, sometime later, having discovered all this and figured out who it belonged to, come knocking on our door in the middle of the night. And then my bloody, drunken, banged up father answers the door. And it was a different time, right? This is like 65 or 66. But the police officer says, Dr. Francis, I'm going to have to give you a citation for this. And my father said, I wasn't aware they gave awards for this sort of thing. I think that's when they took him to jail after that. But those are my people, man. You know, that I grew up around the table with those cats, you know, watching my old man and his brothers and my grandfather, all them polish off whiskey and tell stories like that. And maybe get into a fight, you know? It all looked like what men do to me, you know? And I couldn't wait to get started. And I mentioned that too. For a long time, man, I really needed to know why I was the way I was, you know? And I went to psychiatrists about that. I went to counselors about that. I read books about that. It was really important to me to figure out why I was the way I was. And then I come here and you old timers say, well, David, you drink because you like it. I'm like, I gotta talk to somebody else. But when I say that, I don't mean to minimize the stuff that happens to us when we're kids. Of course, the things that happen to us when we're children are important. What I no longer believe about that is that any of that made me an alcoholic. I just see myself as a freeze-dried alcoholic born, I don't know. If there was a line, my friend Morgan says, if there was a line, I never saw it. You know what I mean? I don't remember crossing a line. I love getting falling down, snot-slinging, hammered, drunk from the day one. You know, it's impossible for a guy like me to control and enjoy his drinking, you know, because if I'm controlling my drinking, it's not enjoyable. And if you had a little videotape of me enjoying my drinking, control would probably not come into your mind as a tagline for that video. So anyway, man, I just think I got here this way. And the older boys in the neighborhood told us kids, if you take a shot of beer every minute, you'll get really drunk and you won't get sick. And we thought that was a solid plan of action. So me and my two mates, we took 12 beers into our fort. We called it our fort. It was really just an abandoned tool shed that was painted psychedelic. And we sat in there smoking cherry cigars around a empty gallon wine bottle that had molten candle wax dripping down. So you gotta be old to remember things like this. They ruined candles when they made them dripless, you know? You could actually create volcanic art. It was really just a monument to wasted time, but but it felt like something you could be proud of, you know? And we sat in there, man, and I remember having a crystal clear thought with those guys. Those four beers are not enough to get me drunk. I've never been drunk in my life, but there's something in me that's intuitively concerned about the supply. So we persevere with the program. I got those four beers in my 12-year-old body, and alcohol did what it does for people like me. It lit me up. I was suddenly 10 feet tall, bulletproof, drastically handsome, apparently able to sing. I was in the presence of the two most interesting cats I'd ever met in my life, and my God, weren't they lucky to hang out with a mad cat like me, man. And by the end of the night, I had vomited and passed out. My available ear was used as an ashtray. I don't remember mustard at the beginning of the evening. But all I know is I came to sometime later, vomited one more time with an ear full of dried cigar ashes and mustard. Head hurt terribly. Could not wait to do that again. That's it. That's freedom right there, baby. You know? And that's it. I drank to get drunk from the start. Drinking is for the purpose of getting drunk. That's all I want to do. It's all I'm interested in. It's all I care about. I want to do that with people who are also interested in doing that. You invite me out for beers. You ever go out with people, hey, you want to go get some beers on Friday night? And you know, sure, man, I'm in. And you go and you're trying to drink with somebody that doesn't really care about drinking. It's awful. You know, they want to have a conversation with you. They appear to be interested in something. You're saying, I'm just like, bro, I'm just trying to, let's get this done, you know? You know, I don't want to drink with people like that. So anyway, man, those people become my friends. I'm told 1 out of 10 people on the planet has alcoholism. I don't even know if that's true. Of course, that means 9 out of 10 people don't, but let's ignore them for now. The good news about that, if you do the math on 1 out of 10 people, that leaves almost 1 billion people left on the planet to party with. And I find you, you know. I don't know if those numbers work out, but in eighth grade, there were probably 50 kids in that class. There were 2 other boys that were interested in not going to that class and going to the woods with me. There's usually some woods drinkers in the crowd. You know, woods drinking, you know? Like, what are you going to do on Friday night? Well, we're going to get some beer and go in the woods. People who aren't alcoholics need more information. They're like, yeah, and then what? You know, I'm like, and then what? You know, I just told you everything I needed to make that decision. Are you in or you out? You know, I mean, so I don't have a great loss story. I have a lot of missed opportunity story. You know, I didn't come here with an estranged wife or children or any of that stuff or college degrees or anything like that. I didn't accumulate things when I was out there. I dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. Found out you could take delivery of large packages on credit, break them down into smaller packages, distribute them to your friends for fun and profit. That seemed like a solid job, and that was fine. And I had a $50 car and a job in a bar. I had to go to work at like 4 p.m. and work till close. 4 p.m. is a solid time to start work. You know what I mean? Just about anybody can be in decent shape at 4 p.m. And they didn't, I was back then, they didn't care if you drank on the job. It was just, you know, it's just what it is. $50 car, cigarette lighter worked. I was super proud of that. And then I'd party till the sun came up and add, you know, rinse and repeat. I started trying to do something about my alcoholism by not drinking as early as high school. I'd put the plug in the jug and I doubled up on my classes. I finished honor roll. I graduated on time with my class. All that proves to me that I've got power, choice, and control. I can handle it, I can take it or leave it, I can put it down anytime I want. I've got this, nothing to see here. By the time I'm 19 years old, I've been to the funerals of 4 of my friends. None of their death certificates say untreated alcoholism. They say stuff like car accidents, gun accidents, motorcycle accidents, and suicide. Those weren't people I just met in class one day. Those were my brothers, those are the cats I was running with. The first dead body I ever saw was my best friend, Tommy Grancy. I got to visit his grave at the Spring Assembly up in Fairfax. I just happened to drive by and I was like, that graveyard looks familiar. Anyway, I'd never seen a dead body before, and you can't show up to something like that sober, you know? And so I rolled up on this thing. It was a room kind of like this, you know, but it was packed, you know? When somebody dies young, the whole community comes out. And I can still see, I can walk into that room in my mind's eye now and see it just like it was yesterday. And I can see him laid out in the back of the room in profile, and oh man, there's Tommy. And I see his mother leave the body of her son and come walking straight through that crowd right to me. She says, David Francis, don't let this happen to you. I suppose somebody sane, somebody present, somebody awake might be able to hear something like that. I'll tell you, I heard it. I didn't say this out loud, but what went through my head was, I ain't as bad as that guy. I don't know why she's picking on me, bro. Nothing to see here. Good information bounces right off of this. don't confront me with the facts. I don't really require them, you know? But the cost of business is getting high, man. You know, the thing about, you know, we read it tonight. Alcoholism is a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, it gets worse, never better. What does that look like, you know? For me, in the beginning, alcohol did a bunch for me and didn't do much to me. You know what I mean? 10 feet tall, bulletproof, drastically handsome, able to sing, leap tall buildings in a single bound. I got this, you know? I could live with a little headache. Maybe I shoot my mouth off a little bit, you know? Hard to imagine, right? Yeah. To the wrong guy, I can live with an ass kicking too, you know? Small price to pay for freedom, you know? But over time, it starts doing more and more to me, which is expected, But what I didn't expect was for it to do less and less for me. And that's the unkind cut, you know? People often say, like, alcohol stopped working for me, and then I'll hear other people argue with them. You know, like, I could still get drunk. I never lost the ability to get drunk. I definitely never lost the ability to get physically drunk. But what I could not get is free. I could not get 10 feet tall, bulletproof, drastically handsome, able to sing. The fierce determination to win stopped coming back, you know? In the end of my drinking, I was afraid to answer my telephone. I was afraid to answer my door. I couldn't look anyone in the eye. I was just walking around full of shame and guilt and remorse. Couldn't keep my story straight. Couldn't remember what lies I told this person or that person. There was a time in my life you could not have the guys I worked with in the same room with my mom, in the same room with my girlfriend, you know. Those people can't all be in the same. I'm a different person with all those people. So the cost of business is getting high. Alcohol is doing less and less for me, more and more to me. I want off the ride. I drank all the fun out of drinking by the time I was 20. I want to stop, right? I really legitimately deep down in my soul, I do not want to live this way. So if you have a drinking problem, the logical thing to do is not drink. Makes sense. Trouble is, I've got alcoholism. Alcoholism demands to be treated. And alcohol treats alcoholism right up until the moment it doesn't, you know? You stop drinking, you feel better, right? I'll tell you what I feel better when I stop drinking. I feel a distinct lack of appreciation from the people around me. I feel insulted. I feel disrespected. I feel frightened. Better. I live in the wrong town. I'm in the wrong relationship. I feel I have to get out of here, you know? Better. So the clock's just ticking on a guy like me, man. No drink, no solution. I know what to do. So I end up setting up this pattern. The last 6 years of my drinking, what it looks like is periods of uncomfortable sobriety followed by periods of uncomfortable drunkenness. You know? And because if I'm miserable drunk and I'm miserable sober, you know which one I'm going to pick, right? There might be one more yeehaw left in there, you know? No, still sucks. Better quit, you know? And, but this, I did a lot of drugs too. I never got an opiate habit, but I kind of gravitated toward the go fast stuff. You got a little something to keep me awake. You got some magic powders to keep me awake. If you ever do the weekend drinking experiment, you're going to need magic powders. Because if you get off work on a Friday afternoon, you got nowhere to be to Monday. You don't want to waste any of that time sleeping. You know? So I go on these patterns of binging and stopping. Eventually, by the way, the weekend drinking experiment, I don't know about you guys, if you ever tried that, or if it's in front of you, but eventually, spoiler alert, the weekend starts on Thursday, finishes up on Wednesday. There's a good solid 6 hours of atonement in there somewhere. So I'm trying to treat my alcoholism by not drinking, by running my show, and I'm sitting in the middle of one of these binges one night. And I can still see this too. Back then there was no cable TV, there was no DVR, nothing like that. You just had to take what the TV offered you. And I'm the poor woman that I'm living with. She's come and gone to work and slept and work and back to sleep. And she's done that several times. And I'm still getting after it, you know. Middle of the night, I'm kind of lonely, you know, watching the TV. And this commercial comes on. And I can still see that. I still see this guy in this dumb commercial. Good-looking dude, khaki pants, open collar shirt, sitting on the front porch of a house. And he says, "I lost my job, I lost my house, I lost my family, but I still have my health." And the voice announcer comes on and goes, "Last year Bob started a whole new life at Serenity Lodge." Yeah. I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. A whole new life, bro. Get me one. It's really a lot. And see, man, like, so I'd write down the number, you know, and then hide it for myself. I'm glad you laughed at that. Alcoholics are the only people I know that hide stuff from themselves.
Future David will never find this.
Yeah, I know, I'm my people, I love you. You can't tell that one at the PTA. So, and I don't know about your head, man, besides always yakking at me, I've got these two parallel tracks that run through my life, and one of these rails is just profound ignorance. I mean, there is a colossal amount of things about which I know nothing. And then parallel to that, there's this other track of arrogance. You really shouldn't choo-choo your little train on that track, you know what I mean? If you're as dumb as I am, you ought to be a little humble. But I'm ignorant and arrogant at the same time. So I know stuff. I'm also burdened with the gift of insight. I don't know if any of you guys suffer from that. I know, for instance, it's better to die cool than to live for 1 minute uncool. I know it's not cool to call people at 3 o'clock in the morning and go, I can't make it. You know, that's why you got to hide numbers from yourself. And then I get up in the morning, I put some distance between me and that particular run, and I could always come up with a new plan. That's it. Got to go. Got to quit. Liquor's gone. Nothing. Everything. No more. It's over. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to be a good man. And that new plan would be enough to propel me into a shower, into a shave, show up at the office. They're not as mad at me as I thought they were. This might work out, you know. And then by noon, I'm starting to get a little thirsty, you know, and a little proud of myself for my new plan. You know, it's kind of cool that we've solved this whole drinking problem, you know. And then you know where this is going. By the time I get off, I should probably, you know, I don't want to quit everything all at once. You know, you don't want to be hasty, you know. Maybe get a six-pack on the way home, take the edge off, you know. And then you go in the 7-Eleven. Obviously, the 12 is a better value. I mean, you got to be fiscally responsible. 12-pack, 3 packs of smokes, down the road I go. And then you know where this ends up. I'm the guy. I'm that guy. Maybe you've been this guy. Maybe you've been the guy behind this guy. I'm the guy in 7-Eleven going, my watch says 11:59, bro. Nobody? All right. I'll go it alone. So one morning I woke up. I didn't have a new plan. I knew I didn't have a new plan. I needed help. I knew I needed help. And stone cold sober, I called that dumb, stupid number for the dumb, stupid Serenity Lodge. And here's the arrogance. I kind of thought they would have heard of me. Oh, you're a legend, bro. We've been waiting for this call. They hadn't heard of me. And they wanted to know what kind of insurance I had. And here's the ignorance. I didn't know why they were asking me that question. I couldn't fathom why insurance had anything to do with your little Serenity house. I'm like, remember Bob and the whole new life, bro? That's why I'm calling you. And they couldn't help me. They hung up the phone. But that was the first time I'd ever asked for any help about my alcoholism. When I used to tell the story, I always say, that's the first time I ever asked anybody for anything my whole life. That is patently false. I asked a lot of people for a lot of stuff all along the way. Help a brother out. You know. But that was the first time I'd ever called about my alcoholism. And I don't know if it was like 3 weeks or 3 months, but I got it into my head. Because the reason it got in my head is my sister, a few years back, had gone into the emergency room at Arlington Hospital, and they whisked her upstairs to a treatment center, and I went to go visit her in the treatment center. I'm talking to my mother. My mother presented it like everybody already knew it. Well, you know Molly's an alcoholic. I'm like, no, this is nothing we've ever discussed. We're all alcoholics. I'm thinking, yeah. And, but I go to visit my little sister, and she is absolutely swacked on Valium up there. She is high as a kite. She is feeling no pain. I'm going to this rehab facility. It's nice and clean. She's high as a kite. The TV's on. I was like, rehab is tight. I can dig a little rehab. You know? So anyway, that's what I had in my little head when I went to the Norfolk emergency room. I was like, I need help. Help me. You know, and so they triaged me, and then they asked me the question, are you a danger to yourself? Here's the ignorance again. I did not understand that question either. I was like, yeah, look at me, bro. I'm not taking very good care of myself. They were like, are you suicidal? I was like, no. So they just stuck me in a room until my blood pressure came down and my heart rate came down, and they streeted me out in that cruel morning light. I don't know about you guys, but when I'm on a run, I'm like a vampire, you know. I gotta be home before the cruel rays of sunshine fall upon my skin. I can't be out there mixing with the good people, you know, people who know where they're going and why they're heading in that direction. I can't be bumping in and conversing with that, you know. And I'm walking out with my 10-foot-wide throbbing head, and in my mind's eye, it's written on a little fortune cookie piece of paper. NIP, Norfolk Inebriate Program, and a number. It's one of these places out by the airport. It's not there anymore. It's one of these places where nothing ever sticks there. You drive by, it's a tarot card reading place. 6 months later, it's a massage parlor. You know, it's always shifting, but the city of Norfolk is running a little non-medical detox there. 72 out, 3 days. So I call that number. I'm like, I need help. The guy says, can you get here? I said, yeah. He said, do you have a toothbrush? Now I'm insulted again. I'm just like, yeah, I got a toothbrush. Well, we'll get your toothbrush and come on in. And I went in. I'm 22 years old. My arms are black and blue. My skin is bad. I'm about 80 pounds heavier than I am tonight. 2 inches taller. I've shrunk in my old age. Fairly hostile, I would say. Not the picture of open-mindedness. Scared to death, really. But I could not have even admitted that or even recognized that in that time. I'm really just scared of walking into a new situation, unknown future. I'm terrified. I don't know. I don't shrink when I get scared. I get bigger, you know? So anyway, I walk in that condition. I can't even put two sentences together to convey an idea, you know? I mean, I'm barely communicating on a human. I could grunt, you know? Smoke in here. You know, that was my complete sentence, you know? And you could, and I did. But what I know about that today is that guy started 12-stepping me. That guy started carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me in that condition, in that chair. And he asked me if I'd ever thought about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I managed to communicate to him, no, sir, I have not. I believe it's some sort of a religious thing, and I'm just not down with all that. And it wasn't nearly that articulate. But that guy says, listen, man, you don't have to worry about that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can make anything your higher power. You can make that doorknob your higher power if you want. And I remember in that condition just having this crystal clear thought. Craziest thing I ever heard. Worshiping doorknobs in Alcoholics Anonymous, bro. You ain't gonna get me like that. That ain't happening. I came up in the 70s, man. There were all kinds of failed communes and weird cults and stuff. And, you know, spoiler alert, some dude's having sex with everyone. That's always the end of the story. But you'd be running around going like, hey, where's Billy? It's like, oh, bro, Billy, the Moonies got Billy. Google the Moonies. They were a thing. So all I'm trying to tell you, man, is that I was not, like, in a hurry to join your little club. You know, I'm a little suspicious of clubs and things like that, you know? But I sat in my very first AA meeting later that day. I can't remember. Doesn't matter. And I wish I had a videotape of what it actually looked like, because all I've got is this sort of psychotic House of Mirrors, Victorian freak show, psychotic memory of it. But it looked like the Walking Dead coming into the room. I mean, the median age of these people was like 175 years old. All of them were smoking. Two of them were on oxygen. Like, if you want what we have. I was like, no. I'm afraid it's contagious. But I started talking to the guy. You think about how weird this place is, man. You know, like, we've got our own language, you know? You know, like, huh, oh, I know how to do the Lord's Prayer. Okay. Keep coming, bring the word, bring it. Oh my God, it's just weird when we come here. We got this other language, and we just expect everybody to know it, right? I didn't know they were called yets, things I hadn't done yet, you know? But I'm steady telling this old man, I never lived under a bridge, you know? I never lost a job. That was a lie. My father had to fire me when I was 14 years old, because his idiot son couldn't stay out of the kitty medicine. But my story is I've never been fired from a job, so don't challenge me with facts. And I still remember, this was 40 years ago when I was 22 years old, man. And that old man said to me, David, alcoholism doesn't care about any of that. Park Avenue to Park Bench. Once you start, you can't stop. And when you stop, you can't stay stopped. If you got either one of those two things, you got a problem you can't solve by yourself. That's how powerlessness was presented to me. And I'm one of the people who said, thanks for the information. See you later. Walked out. Didn't drink, didn't drug for an entire year. Worst year of my life. Absolutely miserable. Absolutely. Restless, irritable, discontent would be a nice way of putting it. You know? The poor woman I'm living with, she can't walk across the room without me having something to say about it. You know? You don't walk across the room with an attitude like that? You think you're better than me? Is that what's going on here? Yeah. Just irritated with everything all the time, because all I really want to do, you know what I really want to do? I want to get ripped out of the frame, falling down, hammered. I like getting regrettably drunk. I like getting so drunk it's a shame. Jeez, look how drunk that dude is. That's drinking. And that's what I really want to do, but I'm not doing it. If you'd have walked up to me during that period of time and said, "How you doing, David?" I'd be like, I'm not drinking. It's like, yeah, bro, you mentioned that about 75 times. How are you doing? I'm like, I just told you. One broken shoelace away from getting hammered drunk, you know what I mean? One broken, give me a reason. Kind of picking fights with people. So you know what happens, I break a shoelace, I get good and drunk, and I put myself in the hospital first night out, almost a year. See, if drinking was the problem, not drinking would be the solution. I'd have been fine, but I'm not fine. This annoys people when I say it, and I'm not deliberately trying to be annoying. The literature tells me that alcohol is just a symptom, right? The old men told me when I got here, David, the good news is you never have to take a drink again. Bad news is, drinking was never your problem. I got a drinking solution. I've got a terribly uncomfortable sobriety problem. Dig it? You got something that fixes an uncomfortable sobriety? Turns out you do. You stuck numbers on it. So anyway, man. Yeah, I put myself in the hospital first night out. Alcohol poisoning. I'd never been hospitalized for drinking before. I've been to the hospital as a result of drinking. You know, broken bones and stitches and better see if he's got a concussion. All that stuff. But never for drinking before. I came to one time. I came to in, anybody remember Mixed Pancake House in Ocean View? Yeah. I know Hickey does. I came to in the fetal position in that parking lot at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and my first conscious thought was, this dude will get tired of kicking me in the ribs sooner or later. That's the kind of stuff that I get up to, you know? I shoot my mouth off at the wrong guy. I don't mind, I'll fight. I remember taking a swing at two sailors one time. That was the last thing I remember that night. So anyway, man, I'm in the hospital for drinking. I wish I could tell you I got out of there and went back to my not drinking and harassing my girlfriend program. But what it marked was 5 years coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll fast forward to the end, man, 1989. My last year of drinking, I remember starting that year drunk as a monkey with my two best drinking buddies, my brother and my father. And I'd just come off like a 45-day dry spell, maybe 2 months or something, you know. And as that whiskey rose to my head, I remember making a decision. I'm done trying to not drink. I'm done trying to stay sober. I'm going to stay drunk for the rest of my life. I'm only happy when I'm drunk. That's it. I'm going to stay drunk for the rest of my life. And if that's 5 days, so be it. If it's 50 years, fine. I don't care. But I'm done trying to stop. And I'm not as tough as some people. I've heard people from podiums like this talk about doing that every day for 30 years. I did it about 3 months. And that particular run was ended in Fairfax, Virginia, a place I had not planned on going when I woke up that morning. But it seemed like a good idea at the time. I was just straightening out one. You ever drive through Old Town 123 in Fairfax? You know that serpentine road? Well, you just got to focus your one good eye and cut a line right straight down the middle. I was just straightening that thing out, you know. Boo goes the lights, you know. And I'd avoided a DUI up until that point. I got into more trouble as a juvenile than I did as an adult. But I was so drunk when that guy pulled me over. The answer to the question, "Have you been drinking, sir?" was, "Yeah, dude, I am hammered. I really should not be operating this vehicle." And since I was honest and nice with him, he kept cigarettes lit and in my mouth in the back of the squad car. So they let me out of jail in Fairfax, a cold February morning, man, and I'm standing across the law office from my grandfather. I never knew my grandfather. I'm trying to hold down that warm sausage and cold orange juice they slid under the rails and or excuse me, it was cold sausage and warm orange juice. They slid under the rails. I'm trying to get that first smoke in, you know, and thinking about my grandfather. I never knew him. He died when I was young, but all my life, man, people have given me tales about my grandfather. Oh, your grandfather was so kind. Oh, your grandfather, he went out of his way for me. He helped my son. Just story after story about the impact that this guy had made in the lives of other people. And I'm standing outside that jail with a hangover, the company truck that I was entrusted with that I wasn't supposed to take out of the city of Norfolk is now impounded in Fairfax. I don't know how much, I don't have enough money. I'm reading the little piece of paper that says you've got to be an officer of the corporation to get the thing out of the impound yard. I assure you I'm not an officer of this corporation. And I'm just standing there, man, going through all this and thinking, God, I got to stop. This is ridiculous. I'm thinking about my grandfather. Like, there's a guy who did something with his life, man. His name rings out. I haven't done anything but wreck stuff and break stuff and hurt people. I'm going to be dead before I'm 30. I don't want to live like this. And my cousin pulls up and goes, hop in, I know where we can get Budweiser's for breakfast. I was like, thank God you're here. I was thinking about quitting drinking. I was three sheets to the wind by noon. I started going to AA again, only because I thought that it would look good for the courts. And you guys all told me that the judge wouldn't care. I don't know, do any of you guys have fantasies? Do any of you guys live in your head? Am I the only one? I knew, this was my idea, I knew that they were going to sentence me to AA when I went up for that DUI. And then I thought, all my bad stories start with, I thought, you know what, I'm going to get ahead of this game. I'm going to go to like 3,000 AA meetings. And when I go to court that day and he convicts me and sentences me to AA, I'm going to say, well, hold on a second, judge. I've been to 3,000 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the judge is obviously going to be so impressed with that. It's unprecedented. No one's ever done this. My God, have you been here all this time? We can't. These charges can't stick. You know, this is the type of stuff that I think. This is what's going on in my head. And I present some version of that to you guys, and you guys are like, yeah, judge isn't going to care. That just proves to a guy like me I'm talking to stupid people. You don't give me any good information. I can't use it. You know? So I ran with that group for a little while, man, and they were an active group, man. They were all, the women had a women's meeting, the men had a men's meeting, they all had a one home group, they all kind of moved around Tidewater as a posse. They'd kind of take over the group conscience of any meeting they went into, you know. They were all about it. They were in it to win it. They were definitely sit down and shut up. You know, I told my sponsor, I was like, I don't want anybody to call on me. I don't have anything to say. He said, nobody's going to call on you. We all know how to get drunk. You know, and it hurt my feelings, you know, but it made sense too. I was like, yeah, that hurts, but that's dead right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I ran with those guys long enough for one of them to hurt my feelings, and I was like, well, that's it, you don't hurt my feelings, you know. So I went back to my own program. I went home, no drinking, softened my position on mild hallucinogens. And that was it. I went back to quitting drinking again. So what happens to me, man, is I'm 6 months abstinent of alcohol. I'd gotten to the point where our book calls the jumping off place. I couldn't picture life with it. I couldn't picture life without it. I'm miserable when I'm drunk, and I'm miserable when I'm sober. If that's all you got to show me, I've seen enough. I'm wishing for the end at this point. I don't want to live anymore. Everything I've tried doesn't work. I'm not happy when I'm drunk, and I'm miserable when I'm sober. I'm out. I've seen enough. So I decided to jump off a building. And if you're shopping for buildings to jump off of, I can help you. You don't want it to be too short. It might not do the job. You don't want to deliver yourself to a condition where you're going to maybe wiggle one of your earlobes. You know, then how are you going to communicate to people how thirsty you are? Trapped with the one thing I've been trying to get away from my whole life, this squawk box in between my ears. I don't know about your head, but mine is always yakking at me. It's always talking to me about me, talking to me about you, doesn't like any of us, doesn't think that the future is particularly bright, you know? It's yak, yak, yak all the time. Watch out for that cat. He hasn't smiled yet. I know. Thanks for sharing. So I'm, but if it's too tall, if the building's too tall, I'm looking at that building, it's too tall, I reckon I might have to spend considerable amount of time in the air. That would make me terribly uncomfortable, possibly regretting my decision. I don't mind being dead, but I don't want to be uncomfortable. And a little voice came up in me, in my own voice, why don't you go to one more of those dumb, stupid meetings? I was like, yeah, okay, I'll go to one more meeting. And then my head immediately chimes in, not that one where they hurt your feelings. No, no, we're not going to go that one. We'll go to the new one. We'll find a new meeting. I knew how to find meetings now, and I'd go find a meeting. It was the We Believe group. They used to meet over by DePaul Hospital on Wednesdays and Sundays. It became my first home group. And you know what it's like when you roll up on a meeting, man. You know, there's half a dozen people standing outside, styrofoam cups, and they're smoking, they're gesturing. They've obviously got big, important deals going on, you know. They've obviously got it all in one sock, you know. Me, I'm just like, I've been spending the day driving around trying to decide which building to jump off of. I got nothing going on. And I get out of the car, I start walking toward that, and I can still see that guy see me. I see him see me. I've been to enough AA meetings, I knew what that meant. I'm going to talk to this guy. I do not want to talk to this guy. And you couldn't hide in a cell phone back then. You know what I mean? You couldn't just, there was no cell phone. You know, so I pretend to drop my keys, you know, bend down and pick them. Yeah, he's still looking at me. But I go walking up there, man, and the guy puts his hand. I was right. Sometimes your head is right, you know. I mean, we didn't survive for no reason. Sometimes you get good, actionable information. Guy sticks out his hand. He says, hi, my name is Walt. I said, hi, Walt, I'm David. And he looks me in the eye and he pats me on the shoulder. He looked me in the eye and he patted me on the shoulder and he said, everything's going to be all right. I mean, I must have looked like somebody who needed reassurance. I never met this guy. And I'm sure he was having a lovely conversation with his buddies. But he was awake to the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to carry the message to the alcoholic, because he was looking for a guy like me. Hostile, frightened, angry. And he took me in the room. He didn't point at the coffee. He got me a cup of coffee. And he walked me over to a chair and he sat me down and he introduced me to another dude. We just got a little chit-chat going. And he had to go chair the meeting. So he patted me on the shoulder one more time. He said, don't worry, nobody's going to call on you. I'm like, this guy's a wizard. Like, how does he know my worst fear is talking in front of a room full of people? I can't talk in front of a room full of people. I failed college courses because I couldn't stand up and talk in front of people. I lose my train of thought, and then I panic. Then I have to run out of the room, maybe leave town. I used to only go to speaker meetings when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew I could just chill out, listen to somebody talk, and get out before, by all means, get out before the prayer. I don't need your poker chip trophy or whatever weird thing, and I don't need your number. I make a big deal out of that, man, because that saved my life. I don't know if that man worked a step in his life, but he offered me a simple hospitality, a simple welcome, a simple greeting, a little bit of comfort. And it was enough, man. I sat in the chair of that meeting. I don't remember what anybody said, but I remember what the tile looked like. I remember what everybody's shoes looked like. But I remember sitting in there, and the thought came to me, I'm going to do what these people do. I'm out of answers. And I knew I was out of answers. I'm just going to do what they do. As pitiful a surrender as that is, I'm going to offer you is enough. I have not had a sincere desire to take a drink since that moment. I don't even know what alcoholism is at this point, right? But stuff started coming out of my mouth that had never come out of my mouth before. I was like, all right, man, you guys talk about sponsorship at every single meeting I go to. What is this? What's the deal with a sponsor? You know, do I have to get them to fund me? Do I have to put their decals on my car? What's the deal with that? No, David, a sponsor is just somebody who's been through the 12 steps, willing to help you do the same. Okay, that makes sense. 12-step program, right? I know it's popular to say that insanity is just repeating the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I got a friend of mine who says, I'll tell you what insanity is. It's attending a 12-step program and ignoring the 12 steps. That makes more sense to me. What's the deal with a home group, man? Is it like a halfway house? Do I have to live there? What is it? It's like, no, David, home group's just a group that you make a commitment to, man. You notice we came here tonight. Somebody came here early and set up the chairs and made the coffee and put the literature out, you know, so that guys like you and I could come here and criticize it. He's like, yeah, that makes sense. I've been doing a lot of that lately. The old man told me, I share this because it's important, it's never ill-served me. The guy just said, David, I suggest that you cultivate a habit of saying yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is going to ask you some things of you. We already know you don't want to do it. I'm like, these people know everything. But stuff started happening, man. Hey, we're all going to Lums after the meeting. You want to go? And my head is screaming at me, no, run home, hide. Yeah, okay, I'll go. And I don't want to go because I'm a big guy. I know I'm going to get stuck in a booth. I know I'm going to get stuck in a booth with two or three people on either side of me, and I'm not going to be able to advocate for myself to get out of the booth. And I was right. I would just sit in there in the booth, man, just locked in there, you know, just about to burst in flames from anxiety. Keep coming back, you know. But I went. I did it anyway. Hey, David, would you make the coffee next week?
Yeah, I don't really know how to make coffee.
We'll show you.
Okay.
And I'm making coffee. Yeah. The old man told me, he said, you remember the 20-20 rule, David. You go, if that meeting's an 8 o'clock meeting, you go there at 8 o'clock, you're late. You go 20 minutes early, you stay 20 minutes late. And I trusted him enough to say, I'm not really, I'm kind of awkward around people. I don't really make small talk and stuff, so I don't really like going and talking to people. He's like, that's fine. You just show up early and just see who's setting up the meeting. Go ask him if you can help him with something. This guy's a genius. I could do that. I started doing it. I just did it. I was dumb enough to just do what the man told me to do. I went early. Sure enough, if you go early to a meeting, you're going to meet the people who care about Alcoholics Anonymous, care about each other, care about that meeting. They're putting chairs up. They're putting literature out. Hey, is there anything I can do to help? Yeah, buddy, glad you're here, man. Put those chairs out, you know. I start putting the chairs out. Now I feel like I'm in the thing, you know. And some other dude walks in. I'm like, hey, bro, help me with this chair. Suddenly, I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, David, would you be the intergroup rep?
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, we don't know what that is either, but... But they meet on the second Tuesday of the month, 7:30, Easy Does It Club. Why don't you go pick up a chair there or come back and tell us everything about it.
Okay.
And I would go. I just started doing this stuff. And I got that sponsor, man. And I was very God-resistant, you know? I had all these ideas about the non-existence of God. I was sort of an evangelical atheist, you know, not an agnostic. I got no respect for agnostics. I got more respect for believers, you know what I mean? Take a position, but don't give me this wishy-washy stuff. And my position was there is no God. And I held on to that, you know. And the old man said, hey, David, could you move it from a no, there is no God over to a maybe there's a God? And I couldn't even admit it in front of him. I'd be at a traffic light, you know, and I'd think, oh, maybe. We suggest you say some simple prayers, David, and we suggest you do it on your knees, morning and night. Help me stay sober today in the morning. Thank you for keeping me sober at night. And the way my prayer started, man, I would get on my knees. I'd be the only one in the place. You tell me what this is. I'm the only one in the place on my knees, and I feel embarrassed. What is that? Somebody smarter than me, tell me after me. And my prayer started like legal briefs, you know? I'd be like, God, if you're there, of course, if you're there, you know you're there. And if you're not there, I feel a little silly, but what does it matter? But the point is, I did it. I just started doing it. Maybe there's a God. That's all you need. Willingness to believe. On we go. Let's make a decision. Start writing the fourth step. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But I like to share this, man, because I went home. My instructions was to write down my fear inventory. What are you frightened of? And I didn't get a technical big book experience. The man just said, go home with a piece of paper, write down what you're afraid of. So I did. I got a piece of paper out. I got a pen, blank sheet in front of me. What am I afraid of? And in my own hand, I see myself write, being alone. I don't mean by myself, man. I mean like forsaken, like friendless, like nobody cares about you. Nobody's glad to see you. Nobody loves you. You're all alone, like some discarded piece of trash in the world. That's the number one thing I'm afraid of. I'm like, I did not know that about myself. I wonder what my number two fear is. You know what it is? It's people. I began to have a spiritual experience on the spot. I was like a little kid, I wanted to put it on the refrigerator. I'm like, look, dig it. I'm afraid of being alone, and I'm afraid of people. You see, this is why I need assistance. This is what I've been trying to tell you people. But I began to wake up. That began to tell me that I was on the right path. I was going somewhere that really had answers. Turns out I got a bunch of them that are 180 degrees out of phase like that. You know what I mean? Like I'm petrified of being broke. I'm scared to death of hard work. I'm scared she's going to leave me. I'm a little concerned she's going to stick around, you know? Oh, shoot. I didn't even get to the good part. I'm giving hope to the newcomers by looking at my watch. Can I do five more? So what I'm going to tell you in a short period of time is something I think is really important. I came here, I did these things, I went through the amends, my relationships with my family was restored, my father when he died was one of my best friends in the world, and I could do an hour on that. What happened to me, man, is that I worked as hard in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see people do this, man, I've seen this model a million times, and sometimes it goes over 30 days, sometimes it goes over 30 years. But we come here busted and disgusted and broken up to do something different, and we get better and we split. And that's what happened to me. I worked as hard as anybody I've ever seen work in Alcoholics Anonymous for like 6 years, and everything I wanted out of life came my way, man. I told you I didn't have a lost story. I had not accumulated anything. All I ever wanted out of my life was to be a family man. I wanted to be somebody's husband. I wanted to be somebody's dad. I imagined that maybe, just maybe, I could maybe even work for own my own business. That's as far as my ambitions went. Didn't really even think any of that stuff was on the table. All of that. Pretty little thing comes along. She likes chocolate ice cream. I like chocolate ice cream. She wants 3 kids. I want 3 kids. Bam! It's clearly God's will. Boom. Maybe I'll have a son. 3 of them come along. 3 beautiful boys. Boom, boom, boom. Business drops in my lap. I mean, not from my entrepreneurial ability, man. Just an opportunity showed up in front of me, and you guys gave me the courage to say, I'll try. Fast forward, 14 years sober, man. I became like the Colonial Place Riverview security block captain for the 500 block of Pennsylvania Avenue. I was a Lamaze coach. I was a Cub Scout leader. I needed a bunch of clipboards in my life back then. And the whole time my life has taken off like that, my attendance and attention to Alcoholics Anonymous just drifted away. And what I've got to tell you about that, what's important to me about that, is I did not make a decision to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't mad at anybody. I didn't think I didn't need to be here. I didn't think I wasn't an alcoholic. I did not even want to drink. It just seemed like everything where I was needed was at 527 Pennsylvania Avenue, man. You know, had little babies, colicky. I just wanted to be that boy's dad, you know. I had a sponsor pass away. I wasn't in a hurry to hire another one. 2 guys I was working with were in the Navy. They deployed elsewhere. I just leaked away one commitment at a time. Fast forward, 14 years sober, hadn't been to an AA meeting in years. Am I late? We're recording this. My wife has a boyfriend. He's inviting me to leave the marriage. My business is failing. My children are indifferent to my comings and goings. I think they were happier when I wasn't around. I was back to that hypercritical. What's wrong, David? Nothing. Seems like something's up. I told you nothing's wrong. Irritable all the time with everyone. My life is burnt to the ground. I'm thinking about suicide again. Stone cold sober. See, if not drinking was the problem, if drinking was the problem, not drinking would have been solved 14 years prior. So I started going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. out of desperation and loneliness, not even because I wanted to drink. My life was burnt down around me. I was like, I'll just go back to AA. I picked up a white chip at every single meeting I went to for a week. Nobody told me to do that, but anytime somebody held up that white chip and said, would anybody here like to try this way of life one day at a time? I stood up and I went, I would. I'd go get that chip. And I expected you guys to swamp me, you know, with phone numbers and love and attention and encouragement. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that you really didn't. But a couple of you did. One of them asked me to coffee. And I thought, you know what, I'll go to coffee with this guy. I got to interview him to be my sponsor, you know. You got to interview him. I mean, I'm bringing all this to the table. I got to see if he's got some game, you know. And I'm telling this guy, I'm in the middle, I'm sitting at Starbucks. I can see that just like it was yesterday. I'm telling him my tale of woe, you know, about all I'd done to this woman, all I'd done for this woman. And he cut me, thank you. He cut me off in the middle of my tale of woe, which I do not like. He said, yeah, man, AA's full of guys like you. You're suffering from untreated alcoholism. I was insulted. The thing is, once you hear the truth, you can't unhear it. He said, and I asked him to be my sponsor. He said, yeah. He said, you got a home group? And I straightened up a little bit because I knew the right answer to that. I said, yes, I do. Big book and get. He said, that's great. What are you doing for them? I was like, you know, I show up most of the time. He said, I want you to be an important member of that home group. Whatever that means to you, I don't care. I want you to be part of what makes that group go. I'll close with this. He said, if you want to work the steps with me, we're going to work them quickly so we can get on with the business of helping other people, because that's why we're here. I'm embarrassed to tell you that that was the first time I heard that message. I treated AA like my own little personal David Feelgood session. If I felt better after I left that meeting, that was a good meeting. That was a good meeting. If I didn't feel good after I left that meeting, that meeting sucked. Never occurred to me I was supposed to bring something. And I will tell you, if you read that beautiful blue book, with that, what happened to me was I recommitted to doing Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time, working the steps with that man, and rereading that book. Do you know that that message that we're here to help other people is cleverly hidden on every single page of that book? And since that time, 18 years ago, I have not crossed the threshold of an AA meeting or picked up the telephone that I was not aware that it was my duty to serve, that I'm here to help. That's why I'm here. I get to be a son to my mother today. I get to be a husband to my wife. That marriage reconciled, by the way. I get to be a father to my children and a friend to my friends. And I get to wake up in a life that really just seems to make sense. Thank you.
Thank you, David F.